You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Twilight at the diner. Hold the waffles, and please hold the sound bites from small-town Trump voters. Opening illustration by Zohar Lazar. And this shows the interior of a diner. At one table, a man sits in a white T-shirt, wearing a Make America Great cap with a Trump campaign button pinned on the side, and he's eating a burger and fries. Across the table from him sits a very conservatively dressed man in a suit, appearing to be taking notes and erasing something on his paper. At another table, being filmed by a cameraman, sits a man in a plaid shirt. Underneath the plaid shirt is a T-shirt saying, "Lock her up," and he's wearing a USA ball-style cap. He's sitting with a very preppy-looking woman wearing glasses and a suit. In the background, you see the diner waitress in uniform carrying coffee and a tray. Nearly 63 million adults voted for Donald Trump in the 2016 election, and our conscientious media will not rest until each and every typical Trump voter within that seething morass has been located, interviewed, profiled, photo-captioned, pondered, and tagged for future taxidermy. Their opinions, no matter how uninformed and frequently la-la, are solemnly recorded as clues to the mood of the country, which always seems to range from disgruntled to thoroughly disgusted. The process to determine what constitutes a typical Trump voter is unwritten, unspoken, and uncodified, but in practice, he or she is drawn straight from central casting. Suburban couples who look as if they just stepped hand in hand out of an episode of HGTV's House Hunters don't make the cut, too bougie and lacking the weathered grain of hard times. Sunbelt retirement villages that went big for Trump occasionally get the extended look in. Generation Pickleball, Welcome to Florida's Political Tomorrowland. By Michael Grunwald, Politico Magazine, June 18, 2018. But the residents, living it up like Del Boca Vista aristocrats, are too set in their ways to offer a gritty dramatis personae for a journalistic parable about Americans in a time of jarring transition. Editors are looking for stories on Trump voters who are making do, soldiering on, hanging tough, wishing each other Merry Christmas instead of that heathen Happy Holidays, and extending the president the benefit of the doubt, no matter how many times he does them rotten. Small town, heartland, blue collar, bingo hall, left behind authentic representatives and descendants of the real America, whom hip elitist bi-coastals and technocrat politicians ignore, until their votes bite Democrats in the butt. So where does an enterprising reporter go to bag a focus group of Trump voters in their native habitat, the local diner? And not just any diner, definitely not one of those silver diners, a chain that offers flexitarian menus, whatever the fancy hell that means, or one of those shiny faux retro diners in the suburbs catering to Happy Days nostalgia. No, it has to be a diner that still offers a wood-paneled haven steeped in the aroma and kitchen grease of yesteryear. A clientele of rumpled regulars, an old cathode tube TV in the corner, and voila! Stephen Witt fires up the coffee pot and flips on the fluorescent sign in the window of the Frosty Freeze, his diner that looks and sounds and smells about the same as it did when it opened a half century ago. Coffee is 50 cents a cup, refills 25 cents. The pot sits on the counter, and payment is based on the honor system. So begins a dispatch from Claire Galafaro, an AP reporter whose special beat is Trump country, in a story dated December 28, 2017. The Frosty Freeze is in Elliott County, Kentucky, a region in worsening distress, which in 2016, for the first time, broke its string of going Democratic, betting on Trump to be the turnaround guy. Trip Gabriel is the New York Times' unofficial Trump-roving diner correspondent. In Iowa, Trump voters are unfazed by controversies. Gabriel opened at one diner. The eight men around a rectangular table, sipping coffee from a hodgepodge of mugs donated by customers, meet daily for breakfast of French toast, eggs, and bacon at Daryl's Diner, then popped into another, where he quoted a waitress who didn't vote in the 2016 election because she didn't like either candidate. Not exactly a gem worth extracting. Reuters reporter Tim Reed also drew blanks when he corralled a trio of Trump supporters at a Bob Evans diner in Jackson, Ohio, and asked their opinions on the Russia investigation. "I have never heard anything about it," imparted Chastity Banks, "and neither had the other two Trumpies." At Nana D's diner in Mesa, Arizona, CNN interviewed a quartet of Trump supporters over the family separation policy at the border that was ripping children from their parents. "I think people need to stop constantly bringing up the poor children," complained one old dear. "Quit trying to make us feel teary-eyed for the children." Yes, that does sound like the heartfelt, cankered voice of a Trumpian. The journalistic device of converting diner patrons into field studies didn't originate in the aftermath of Trump's upset victory. It's a hoary practice that became a staple in campaign coverage of political caucuses and primaries in Iowa and New Hampshire, where the diner became the go-to spot for getting the ornery lowdown from the red flannel plaid set. The Deadline laureate of this hunter-gatherer journalism was the Washington Post reporter and columnist David Broder, the dean of the Washington Press Corps, who knocked on doors at dinner hour, interviewed subjects on park benches, and convened impromptu focus groups of diner patrons to get a feel for shifts in sentiment that had eluded correspondents trailing candidates from stop to stop. Broder put in the shoe leather and brought back the goods on his Tocquevillian rounds. But today, that approach has become a cliché, a traffic jam, a theatrical genre. The patrons have become self-conscious in their role-playing as average Americans, trying to finish their cardboard waffles while the politicians go glad-handing from table to table, surrounded by a scrum. It is unusual, however, to keep returning to diners, bars, and American Legion halls to take the temperatures of one sliver of the electorate and gussy up their predictable sound bites with descriptive dabs of short story-ish scene setting. The Washington Post Alexandra Petri did a hilarious send-up of this woebegone naturalism. In the shadow of the old flag factory, Craig Slavornik sits whittling away on a rusty nail, his only hobby since the plant shut down. It not only privileges the attitudes of one subset of voters, but it leaves a lopsided impression of the whole mural. The media is blinded by its obsession with rural white Trump voters, Ryan Cooper arguably, forcibly argued in a column for The Week last December. Trump does, or did, have unusual levels of blue-collar support. But the actual bulk of Trump support is the same old professional petty bourgeois and ultra-wealthy capitalist who have been voting Republican for generations. And, Cooper notes, this zoom in on rural whites has largely ignored the black and brown working class, who never fell for Trump's nonsense. Since the election, we've heard a steady tom-tom beat, even from those on the left, such as Bernie Sanders, that it was economic anxiety that drove many traditional white working-class voters away from the Democrats into the Pelican flappers of Donald Trump. But the hate, bigotry, and cackling cruelty of the Circus Maximus that is Trump's first term carries too loud a primal yowl to be ascribed to stagnant wages and factory closings. Something far more septic and serrated is going on. Deep data mining, as opposed to anecdotal fishing at the diner, has unearthed a more plausible driver for the Trump victory. Not economic anxiety, but racial animosity. A roundup of post-election studies and surveys by German Lopez at Vox cited a paper by a trio of social scientists that found that voters' measures of sexism and racism correlated much more closely with support for Trump than economic dissatisfaction after controlling for factors like partisanship and political ideology. The headline for a long, exhaustively detailed article in The Nation by Sean McElwee and Jason McDaniel slammed home the point with a 2x4. Economic anxiety didn't make people vote Trump. Racism did. I'd like to toss something else into the mix when it comes to diagnosing what's eating at the craw of the typical Trump voter. A raging hatred of liberals. Liberals, especially the liberal media, have become the all-purpose blame bucket for everything, and owning the libs, the primary directive of the Steve Bannon Brigade. It reveals its snarling face at the Trump rallies that the cable networks insist on covering, putting their reporters in jeopardy as Trump lashes up a hate storm over fake news and incites his supporters to get their freak on against the liberal media, which some of them do with gusto, hectoring, spitting, bellowing F-words from their hippo mouths, and flipping the middle finger, a terrible way for Grandpa and Grandma to behave. With each Trump rally drawing a larger faction of conspiracy nuts, the threat of violence gains velocity as reporters from some of the very outlets paying such nuanced attention to typical Trump voters, the New York Times, CNN, and so on, are reviled as enemies of the people. Time to drop a cloth over this parrot cage. I think we've heard more than enough verbal static from the Trump base. There's nothing more to learn from them, and it's time the doting stopped. Mark your calendars for October 8th through the 10th, 2018. Los Angeles Wallace Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts. The Vanity Fair New Establishment Summit. Set in Beverly Hills, the summit brings together renowned speakers for inspiring conversations on the issues and innovations shaping our future. Bob Iger, Hannah Gadsby, Palmer Luckey, Rashida Jones, Dara Khosrowshahi, Monica Lewinsky, John Stanky, Audrey Gelman, A.G. Salzberger, Moj Modara, David Solomon, Diablo Cody, Radhika Jones, Chase Carey, Alanis Morissette, Emily Chang, and more. For more information, visit vfsummit.com. Writer's Room by Joy Press. Just FYI, can the reboot of Murphy Brown succeed in the media whirlwind it saw coming 30 years ago? Photo illustration by Matt Chase. 26 years after the Dan Quayle Murphy Brown dust-up made front pages, the new series is poised for modern headlines. And in the illustration, a paper is shown folded to reveal the front half, the top half of the front page. Metro Final Daily News, New York's hometown newspaper. Thursday, September 27th, 2018. Murphy Brown is shown on the left side, tinged in blue, smiling, wearing a suit jacket, hand in pocket. Trump is on the left side, tinged, right side rather, tinged in red, wearing a suit, striped tie, holding his hands as if to make a megaphone and shouting, and the headline says, Trump mouths off to Murphy Brown, sad. Looking around at what was going on in our world and our country, I was feeling that if ever a show had a reason to come back, it would be this, says legendary TV show runner Diane English, waving her hands as if to suggest Trumpian malice vibrating around us. We are sitting in a swelteringly hot production office on the Warner Brothers back lot in Burbank, where English is relaunching Murphy Brown, the sitcom about a waspy and waspish investigative journalist that became central to the culture wars of the early 1990s. Chances are good that the CBS revival, starring Candace Bergen in the ornery lead role once again, will become the show that deplorables love to deplore. It might even trigger a few fiery tweets from the White House. There would be precedent. The topical humor of Murphy Brown, mining politics for entertainment, originally attracted viewers of all ideological stripes and created fodder for a real-life line of attack from a sitting vice president. In other words, it anticipated the political reality of 2018 by a generation or so. In Washington, everybody on both sides of the aisle watched that show, English says, recalling how Republican senators like Orrin Hatch and Arlen Specter sent her headshots. There weren't DVRs then, so you had to be in front of your TV, and I was told that the Beltway emptied out on Mondays at 9 o'clock. English and Bergen had occasionally joked about remaking Murphy Brown over the years, such as when Sarah Palin was a vice presidential candidate. Murphy, after all, had a knack for calling out hypocrisy and idiocy. But it wasn't until after the 2016 election that English seriously entertained the idea. When Warner Brothers approached her about it, she procrastinated for months, delivering a script right before Christmas 2017. By the first week of 2018, she had a straight-to-series deal with CBS, Murphy Brown's home from 1988 to 1998. Only after conferring with Bergen and original stars Joe Regalbuto, Frank Fontana, Faith Ford, Corky Sherwood, and Grant Shaud, Miles Silverberg, did English agree to reboot the Murphy machine. When Murphy Brown premiered in November 1988, the country was in the midst of a war for the soul of America, as pundit Pat Buchanan once dubbed it. Rallying around the idea of family values, the religious right hammered away at affirmative action, feminism, gay rights, and indecent art. Liberals were denounced as members of the cultural elite, who, as Vice President Dan Quayle later warned, lurked in newsrooms, sitcom studios, and faculty lounges. English steered her sitcom directly into this storm when she decided on a season 4 storyline in which Murphy, age 42 and single, gets pregnant and decides to keep her baby. Hoping to shore up the Republican base during the 1992 presidential re-election campaign, Quayle made a speech in the wake of the L.A. riots that linked black welfare mothers to a fictional white privileged woman. Murphy, Quayle claimed, was mocking the importance of fathers by bearing a child alone and calling it just another lifestyle choice. The story gripped the media. An image of Murphy and her newborn appeared on the front page of the New York Times, and the New York Daily News headlined its cover story, "Quayle to Murphy Brown, You Tramp." Bush lost to Bill Clinton, and Murphy Brown won Emmys for Best Comedy, Best Actress, and Best Direction that year, ending the season as the third most watched show in the country. Faced with a contemporary news environment that makes the Quayle era look quaint, English needed to assemble a team that could bring her characters into the present. As the President of the United States labels the news media the enemy of the American people and cozies up to world leaders who murder and imprison journalists, Murphy's dedication to muckraking will take on new resonance. We want to educate people about what actual journalists do and how they really have to verify things, says English. People don't know this because they believe the president, who says they're making it all up, anonymous sources, they don't exist. Then there's the comic friction inherent when broadcast-era journalists confront the nonstop digital age. In the original series, Murphy worked at FYI, a network news magazine. Now the show runs on cable. Back in the day, Corky was a young ex-pageant queen struggling to be taken seriously. Now she is a menopausal veteran dealing with ageism. The new kid on the block in 2018 is Murphy's 20-something son, Avery, Jake McDorman. He has followed his mom into journalism, albeit at a conservative network, where he is a bit of the voice of reason, says English, who compares him to Fox's Shepard Smith. Of course, she says dryly, he and his mother often disagree on things. Many of the show's original writers had stayed in close touch with English, and six of them joined the room, along with three younger recruits. "I am the youth translator," newcomer Gina Ippolito says with a chuckle. On any given day, she might find herself explaining acronyms like SMH and FWIW. Conversely, she says, I might ask, how would someone who was 70 phrase this? While working on an episode with a hashtag MeToo-inspired storyline, she says the writers tossed around questions like, what is the difference between behavior that was acceptable now and 30 or 40 years ago? After reading the scripts for the first two episodes, Candace Bergen was relieved to find Murphy at her vintage, scathing best. She certainly does not hold back, Bergen tells me gleefully over the phone from New York. It's all there, she promises, the wacky physical humor and slapstick, and then very tough attacks on various people in the administration. It's allowing people to vent a certain amount. The writers themselves are also adjusting to our light-speed news cycle. It takes months to bring a scripted series from conception to broadcast. Yet today's White House star may well be tomorrow's Scaramucci. English pushed for the tightest turnaround time between shooting and airing, and they've got wiggle room to plug in last-minute topical elements. It's a digital world now, so you never lock picture, and you can go back in at the very last minute, English says. They are currently scheming about how to put their spin on the midterm elections, but mostly they plan to focus on topics. Climate change, immigration, sexual harassment, abortion, the Supreme Court, that will only get more explosive. In today's noxious environment, a politically charged comedy can be a perilous proposition, as Roseanne discovered during its ill-fated revival this spring. Roseanne and Murphy Brown initially premiered just weeks apart in the fall of 1988. Although in many ways the two shows couldn't have been more different, Murphy revolved around a successful career woman, while Roseanne centered on a working-class mother struggling to get by in flyover country. They both redefined family values. And their abrasive lead characters stretched America's ideas of female likability on TV. English admired Roseanne back then, and gracefully offers that she appreciated the revival's attempt to touch on different points of view within the Connor family. Blonde and elegant, English bears some resemblance to her famous character. But unlike Patrician Murphy, English comes from a blue-collar family in Buffalo, New York. She says she has encountered similar tension when she goes back home. That first Thanksgiving after the election was tough. We had Trump people, we had Hillary people, and we made a pact that we weren't going to talk about it. And then, you know, she says with a shrug, it didn't last. Someone mentioned to English that it would be funny to invite Quayle to appear in the revival. It's not funny to me, English snaps, her perfect composure giving way to a flicker of anger. By putting that person on our show, it would be kind of wink-wink, it was just all for entertainment. And it wasn't. It was really feeling like the end of the world. I had to have protection walking to my car, she says, shaking her head at the memory. When you have the Vice President of the United States literally blaming you for the fall of Western civilization and trading barbs on the front page of the New York Times, it's a little daunting.
Thank you.
The Parkland Ground Game by Dave Cullen. The March for Our Lives movement began with an eruption of anguish, but changing America's gun laws will take long-term logistical prowess. That's where Jacqueline Corin comes in. Photographs by Paul D'Amato. Opening photo, March for Our Lives students at St. Sabina Academy in Chicago for the kickoff of their two-month summer bus tour, hashtag Road to Change, in June. Jackie Corin, Jamal Lemmy, David Hogue, Diego Pfeiffer, Sophie Whitney, Cameron Kasky, Matt Deesh, Taya Amoy Roberts, Alfonso Calderon, Kira Simon, Samantha Deesh, and Victoria Gonzalez. She had no room for error. The engines were already fired up, and Jackie Corin had 36 hours to bus 100 Parkland survivors 900 miles round trip to Tallahassee, just 6 days after the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School on February 14th. Most of the kids had come to her mandatory meeting the previous night from funerals. In Tallahassee, they hoped to extract unlikely promises of new gun regulations from a state legislature controlled by Republicans. They were already in week six of Florida's eight-week annual legislative session, and a bill hadn't even been drafted. "We have about 10 days to craft really important legislation," State Representative Kristen Jacobs told me, "because it's a whole year before the legislature comes back together, and the momentum will be completely lost." Even if they somehow struck a deal, the bill would go to Governor Rick Scott, a Second Amendment warrior with an A-plus NRA rating. Jackie had dreamed up, organized, and set the mission in motion over the weekend, working with her state senator to feed, house, transport, and chaperone the 100 miners, coax top officials to meet with them, and fund the whole undertaking. Despite the odds, everything had gone smoothly until now. It was Tuesday afternoon, and Jackie's recruits crammed the parking lot of Publix supermarket, the one near the Walmart, Jackie had clarified at the meeting, each holding two different releases signed by their parents. Three jumbo coach buses rumbled noisily, ready to roll. The press had appeared en masse, nearly outnumbering the students, and a news chopper buzzed overhead. The eight-hour journey itself was now a media spectacle. Leading national newscast, and the governor had agreed to meet. But a slew of last-minute glitches delayed their departure by nearly an hour. That's when one of the bus drivers demanded that Jackie pay for his Tallahassee hotel room. "He got out of the bus and started walking away," Jackie told me later. "I was a mess. I was crying. I kind of had a breakdown. I have so much pressure on my shoulders. You cannot be doing this." She agreed to pay, and he took the wheel. "I've spent 6 months covering Jackie, who is one of the lead organizers for March for Our Lives, MFOL. I have seen her stressed and overloaded, bending but never breaking. During the Tallahassee trip, she exuded a steadfast calm. Students requested last-minute reassignments to sit with friends. No, she said sternly, get on your bus. A school board member agreed to chaperone, but kept chatting with me after the buses were loaded. Jackie whisked by, addressing another obstacle. "No more interviews," she whispered, without looking up. The school board member sheepishly turned to find his seat. She was never mean, just firm. Jacqueline Corin, more comfortable as Jackie, is a petite blonde teenager with fair skin, flowing hair, and a soprano voice that doesn't carry in crowds. But she has a presence and relentless tenacity. Jackie was elected freshman class vice president and president of her sophomore, junior, and now senior classes. She knows how to get things done. I met her dad, Paul, in the Publix parking lot as he watched in disbelief as Jackie managed the chaos. "She's always been a go-getter," he said, "active in school leadership since middle school. But this? He could never imagine this. I'm in awe," he said, "of my own daughter. I want to take her when she gets back to get her DNA testing, because I saw her come out of my wife, but I'm not sure I could produce this." Jackie Corin helped create hashtag NeverAgainMSD, which evolved into MFOL. She will never command a stage like Emma Gonzalez, match the fire of David Hoag's Twitter feed, or keep the faithful giggling like Cameron Caskey, who delighted in telling reporters that he thought up the name hashtag NeverAgain while sitting on the toilet in his Ghostbusters pajamas. But Jackie is a natural implementer and a driving force behind the scenes. In its effort to make gun control a priority for midterm voters, MFOL has mobilized on two fronts, inspiring a massive following and then building a network across thousands of high schools and colleges to drive young people to the polls. The first half was widely publicized. Emma alone has 1.6 million Twitter followers. But while she, David, and several others light up the internet, Jackie tackles the logistics. Movements are born from hope, but they are built brick by brick. That's Jackie's department. If these kids rock the vote on Election Day, Jackie Corin will be a crucial reason why. The Parkland uprising seemed to erupt out of nowhere, but it had been 2 decades in the making. The school shooter era began at 11:19 a.m. MDT on April 20th, 1999. I arrived at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado, a little after noon that day to cover the aftermath. The pain I witnessed is seared into me, but nothing prepared me for the next morning when I saw the faces of the kids who had survived. Their eyes were dry, their faces slack, their expressions had gone vacant. That's why I'm still on the story 2 decades later. I never wanted to see that look again. But what we see today is worse. Unsurprised survivors, kids who expected something like this. The media coverage of Columbine was unprecedented. CNN logged its highest ratings ever, and the New York Times covered the story on its front page for 11 straight days. It was an exceptional moment, demanding exceptional action. Law enforcement and the education system responded with some important changes, including the active shooter protocol, and then we came to accept it. There were no vacant stares from the Parkland survivors. This generation grew up on lockdown drills, and they were primed for action this time. Jackie Corin and her friend Cameron Caskey crouched in lockdown for 3.5 hours, getting updates on the carnage by text and Twitter, as 17 students and staff were killed around them, long enough to ride the waves of fear to simmering anger. Jackie and Cameron went to bed that night, nursing notions that would give birth to a movement. Speed, that was the first answer to the question on everyone's lips this spring. Why is this time so different? Jackie, Cameron, and David Hoag started simultaneously in the hours after the attack on 3 separate and distinct paths. That was Wednesday, February 14th. By Saturday, they had joined forces with Emma Gonzalez and others, other emerging leaders, to launch the hashtag NeverAgainMSD movement. Their efforts have upended the gun control conversation in the United States, giving 2 decades' worth of survivors new hope. "I am in awe of what is happening," Connie Sanders told me in March. Her father, Dave, was the Columbine teacher who had remained in the building, saving hundreds of students until he came face to face with the killers. He was shot and hours later died of his wounds. Next photo, most likely to organize. If we were all talk and no action, people wouldn't take us as seriously, says Corin, photographed at home in Parkland. And School of Thought. MFOL activist Emma Gonzalez and Tyra Hermans meet with Chicago activist Trevon Bosley and Ariana Williams on day two of the hashtag Road to Change tour. It's working, Connie told me, all these years, and it's working. It was speed, then it was candor. Shortly after dawn, on the morning after the attack, David Hogue was on CNN, calling out adults for failing his classmates. We're children. You guys are the adults, he said. You need to take some action and play a role. Work together. Come over your politics and get something done. But as he spoke those words, David seemed to grasp that the kids would have to do it themselves. That Saturday, Emma rejected a lifetime of assurances that nothing could be done to protect kids from guns. We call BS, she declared 6 times in a searing speech that turned her into a national sensation by nightfall. Speed and candor were critical to their launch, but the third element was vital to the goal of building an enduring grassroots movement, the long, steady slog of igniting a youth activist network across all 50 states. At 17, Jackie can't vote. She can't even check into a hotel room, but that hasn't stopped her from crisscrossing the country since Valentine's Day, meeting with school groups and legislators. She estimates she has logged at least 30,000 miles traveling as far as Kenya. I want to address the young people in the room that might not feel like they can do anything, she said at a town hall in Denver. I'm only 17. I'm not even old enough to vote. I am pre-registered. What you can do is, you can start clubs in your schools. You can join local clubs like Never Again Colorado, like Students Demand Action. You can talk to people that might not look like you, that might not understand your perspective on these issues. You can grab a clipboard and go to your local park and pre-register voters. You can do so many things, even if you can't vote yourself. In fairness, Jackie has always been an overachiever. Until high school, she was serious about dance. She did tap, jance. She did tap, jazz, and hip-hop. But her passion was pointe. Dance was my life and my love, she said, but she gave it up in high school to focus on her studies and student government. As a junior, she took on 5 AP courses, though valedictorian was out. Sophomore year, I got 1 B+, she told me. It was my 1 B+ my entire life. She wasn't going to let that happen again. Her dad, Paul, describes her as brilliant and very emotional, but she's not showing it because she's laser-focused right now. I've never seen Jackie lose her composure, but she keeps telling me about breakdowns. An early one came about a week after Tallahassee when she returned to Douglas High for the first time since the massacre. As she was leaving, a car ran over a water bottle. The pop sounded nothing like a gunshot, but triggers are often irrational. She sobbed uncontrollably for several minutes. For weeks afterward, Jackie was terrified by bathroom trips. The people who went to the bathroom in the freshman building, they were targets because they were in the hallway, she said. They were easy targets. That's what's scary about it. Out in the open, unprotected. Jackie's fears have since faded, but they lurk and swell unpredictably in waves of silent terror that can knock her back at any moment. Her adversaries do what they can to make it worse. Her team has been hounded by death threats and scary packages. The Parkland activist seems so confident and media savvy on television, but they are high school kids. Most had never seen a gun until a SWAT team burst in and marched them out of their classrooms, hands raised. Stealth fear was a constant companion on the hashtag Road to Change, this summer's marathon bus tour across 15,000 miles of America. The tour was the movement's big push to influence the midterms, which has been their objective ever since they concluded, way back on Valentine's Day, that passing effective gun legislation meant changing our legislators. "We could very well die trying to do this," Emma Gonzalez told me in D.C. A few hours before, she closed the Washington rally with a speech climaxing in a spellbinding 4.5 minutes of silence. "We could get shot by someone who's like, 'Don't take away my guns,' which is not what we're trying to do. We're not trying to take away anybody's guns, but they misconstrue our message because they're afraid of this becoming a slippery slope. Or they're afraid of us because we have a voice now." Next photo, where it counts. Students at a rally in Chicago display price tags showing their value to Senator Marco Rubio. The amount of his NRA donations divided by the number of students in Florida. And that amount is a paltry $1.05. The day after the shooting, Cameron Caskey, actually, let's look at this photo again, because the price tags are upside down. And sorry to say, it does indeed appear that the price tag says $1.05. To continue, the day after the shooting, Cameron Caskey began envisioning the big march. 5 weeks to pull it off felt borderline reckless. But by the time he invited Jackie to join him the next day, she was already organizing another operation. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.